May it please the court. Mr. Olivares. My name is Catherine Stevenson, registration number 45798, here with co-counsel Gail Johnson, appearing on behalf of Charles Smith in this appeal. We are here today on two issues, both on de novo review. The first being whether the record fails to affirmatively demonstrate that Mr. Smith made a knowing, voluntary, and intelligent waiver of his fundamental right to a jury trial, which violated his federal and state constitutional rights. Now, I know that Chief Judge Loeb, sitting on this panel today, authored the decision in Walker from the Court of Appeals, and so I know that this court is well familiar with this issue. But it is our position and our argument here today that the Colorado Supreme Court's holding in Walker is mere dicta and is not controlling here because it did not address the federal claim that Mr. Smith raises. And as the United States Supreme Court has made clear, the express and intelligent consent of the defendant must be set forth and spread on the record prior to finding a valid waiver of a fundamental constitutional right.
Ms. Stevenson, let me ask you this. What portion of Walker, the Supreme Court opinion in Walker, are you contending as mere dicta?
The fact that Mr. Smith cannot raise this issue on direct appeal and that he must wait until post-conviction proceedings to raise this issue.
So let me expand on that a little bit. I've read the Supreme Court opinion in Walker, and I really had trouble with some of your arguments in your brief trying to distinguish it, particularly in terms of that they didn't talk about a constitutional issue. There are several places in the opinion where they appear to say the standard is knowing, voluntary, and intelligent, and that's the constitutional standard that we're applying. So how is that dicta?
Yes, I agree, Your Honor. And I would point this court in the direction of paragraph 10 of the Walker opinion, in which it addressed that it was specifically addressing Walker's argument that he raised under a rule-based argument. Also, continued in paragraph 17, later in the opinion, the Walker court states that the first issue that it is addressing is whether a court's advisement that fails to comply with the colloquy set forth by statute constitutes error requiring an evidentiary hearing. And thus I submit to this court that because the court chose to decide that issue on a narrow basis, that it's not controlling in this issue.
Ms. Stevenson, doesn't make any difference that the Supreme Court in the second sentence of its ruling said we hold that a defendant may not litigate the validity of such a waiver on direct appeal, but must do so in a post-conviction proceeding in the second sentence, and then repeated that exact same holding six more times in the opinion. That I'm having a hard time seeing that that's dicta.
Yes, Your Honor, I understand. But I do submit that the court chose to decide the issue narrowly, and perhaps it was because of this exact federal issue that is being raised here today by Mr. Smith, because federal law makes clear that when the record fails to affirmatively demonstrate that it was a waiver that meets constitutional muster, it must be reversed on direct appeal. And so to decide it under the rule is different than when a defendant is raising it as a federal constitutional claim.
Counsel, but practically speaking, if that were the case, no defendant would ever bring a rule-based challenge. They wouldn't need to. They could just say, as you're saying, well, the record doesn't affirmatively show it's knowing, intelligent, and voluntary, period. Therefore, we don't need to make a rule-based claim.
Yes, Your Honor, I do agree with that, that the correct challenge is to bring it under a federal claim. And that's because the rule is merely a procedural device that was there to assist trial courts in determining the knowing and the intelligent inquiry, to determining whether it is a constitutionally valid waiver. And we know from Colorado courts and from the Supreme Court that there's no constitutionally mandated colloquy, that so long as the record makes clear that it was a knowing, intelligent, and voluntary waiver, that's sufficient. And that each case comes down to the particular circumstances of that individual's case. And so from Johnson v. Zerks, we know that when it's a waiver, we're dealing with the specific individual's background, the specific individual's conduct throughout the proceedings, and his experience with the judicial system that could impact a court's decision in determining whether it's been a valid waiver or not.
But in this context, hasn't our Supreme Court held that What also might be relevant to determining whether the waiver is knowing, intelligent, and voluntary are, for example, discussions that he had with counsel. And how can a record be made of that at any point in a direct proceeding? And doesn't that have to be made in a 35C proceeding?
Correct, Your Honor, but I believe it is in Patton, the United States Supreme Court held over 80 years ago that it is the serious and weighty responsibility of the trial court to ascertain the validity of a waiver of a fundamental constitutional right on the record. And thus, these rules provide a procedural device in order to ascertain whether it meets constitutional muster.
Exactly, but that only addresses the first question, and that question is whether there's an error. That doesn't go to whether the error requires reversal. And that's what the court is concerned about, that in a 35C, you can flesh out whether, despite any infirmity in the advisement or any infirmity in the existing record, the defendant nevertheless understood what his rights were and was willing to waive them.
And Your Honor, I believe that, I agree, and I believe that's a specific issue that differentiates this case and Walker from the Colorado Supreme Court's holding in Moore v. People and in Blenn, which was modified by Moore, in which the issue that we are dealing with here today is a structural error in the entire framework of Mr. Smith's proceedings, whereas the right to testify has never been held as such. So in this instance, when there is error, it's automatically reversed.
Well, I guess the thing that all three of us are struggling with a little bit is kind of our role as an intermediate appellate court. I mean, we are bound by what they decide up on the fourth floor. And we've got a case here that, as Judge Hosmer said, six times they say this is what our holding is. I just am struggling with how, you know, our limited role as an intermediate appellate court, we can try to fiddle with their holding. Can you help me with that?
Yes, Your Honor, I will try. I submit once again that because the court chose to use the language that it did to narrowly decide the issue on the rule-based violation, that it is not holding, that it is not controlling in this case. And the United States Supreme Court made clear in Boykin that the question of an effective waiver of a federal constitutional right is of course governed by federal standards. And when we apply all of the federal standards set forth by the court from Patton, from Boykin, from Conley, it's clear that when it's not affirmatively demonstrated on the record, and in this case compounded by the fact that Mr. Smith suffers from severe mental illness, and that there was no inquiry made as to whether he was taking his medication that day, whether he understood the significance of his right, and whether he understood the consequences of relinquishing it, it is clear that it's not on the record to affirmatively demonstrate that there was a knowing, valid, and intelligent waiver. And in this case, retrospective inquiry is not going to provide this court with a more reliable answer as to whether Mr. Smith's waiver was constitutional at that time.
Why not? How can we say that defense counsel didn't completely, thoroughly, repeatedly, properly advise the defendant of all these rights, and he told his defense counsel, I understand, and I don't want a jury trial? I mean, how do we know that? And since the problem here is that we need to assure that the waiver is, as you say, knowing, intelligent, and voluntary, but that involves the totality of the circumstances, and one of those circumstances may be discussions with counsel. Okay, and what you're proposing is a rule that, if adopted, would require a court to inquire of counsel about discussions with a client at the hearing on whether the jury trial is waived. Isn't that the necessary result of your argument here?
Supreme Court, yes, Your Honor, the Supreme Court mandates that it is set forth on the record prior to finding any waiver. So a purported waiver is not valid until it's set forth on the record prior to trial. And we are not raising this as an IAC claim or an ineffective assistance claim in which there has been a waiver of attorney-client privilege. This is raised on direct appeal because the trial record fails to affirmatively demonstrate that he knowingly and intelligently relinquished a fundamental constitutional right, the violation of which results in structural error in this case.
But doesn't the result that you're advocating mean that at a hearing on this waiver, court, after hearing from the defendant, will then have to say, Mr. Smith, counsel for the defendant, please take the stand and raise your right hand. I'm now going to question you about your discussions with your client so that I can make sure that his waiver is voluntary, knowing and intelligent.
No, Your Honor, I disagree. I think it could be set forth on the record. Did you have adequate time to talk with your counsel on this issue? Do you understand the right that you are giving up? That doesn't have to be a question posed to defense counsel because it is a personal fundamental right and it would need to come from the defendant himself.
But here, you wouldn't say that was sufficient. You're claiming that your client was, because of his mental issues, wasn't capable of making those sorts of decisions.
No, Your Honor, I'm claiming that he wasn't sufficiently informed of what the consequences and the significance of his right was. None of the advisements from the rule, in our statute, the mandated rule, was given to him. He didn't know what his right was to give up at the time.
How do we know that he didn't know? How do we know?
It's the serious and weighty responsibility of the trial court to set that forth on the record.
But that doesn't mean we don't know. I mean, that doesn't mean we know. I mean, that's a non sequitur. We can't know until we know all the circumstances.
I understand. If I may turn to the second issue at hand today, that is whether the evidence is sufficient to support a conviction for first degree assault where the evidence fails to establish that Mr. Smith acted with a specific intent to cause serious bodily harm. To remind the court, Mr. Smith concedes in his opening brief on pages 34 and 35 that the evidence was sufficient to support a conviction for second degree, and he concedes this point. But the issue today is whether he had the conscious objective to cause serious bodily harm, and specific intent cannot be presumed or inferred from the commission of the act itself. And because the government relies only on facts that constitute the actus reus itself in this case, including the nature of the attack, the weapon used, and the part of the body that sustained the injury, there is no record evidence that provides any other information as to what Mr. Smith's specific intent was that day.
So let me ask you a question about that. What does it mean when they use the words the act itself? Is it in this case simply taking, and I can't remember what it was, whether it was a screwdriver or whatever, just the simple act of taking a screwdriver and punching it into the woman's back? Or is the act itself mean something broader than that? Because clearly the evidence that was put on was broader than the sheer act of just stabbing the woman.
Of course, I agree. I believe it comes down to the evidence that creates the actus reus itself. So the conduct and the result of the act would constitute the actus reus or the act in this instance.
Is there a case law that supports that interpretation that you've just given me?
I could definitely submit a supplemental briefing on that issue if the court would desire. I do not have a cite for it right now.
Why isn't it reasonable for a reasonable jury or juror to be able to infer that the defendant intended to inflict serious bodily injury when he stabbed the victim with a screwdriver that had been sharpened like an ice pick? Isn't that fairly reasonable inference from that the defendant intended to inflict serious bodily injury?
Your Honor, I would point this court in the direction of Armijo v. People, where it says that specific intent cannot be presumed or inferred from the commission of the act itself.
Well, we're not presuming or inferring it from the commission of the act itself, but what he used to commit the act. There's an outside piece of evidence here, not just the act itself, but he happened to have a sharpened screwdriver that's sharpened like an ice pick. Isn't that a reasonable inference that he intended to inflict serious bodily injury?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe that that's the human nature, that's our natural response to looking at the facts that underlie the actus reus in this case, and to say he must have had the conscious objective to cause serious bodily harm if he hit her there with that. But this case requires a gut check, because we have to remember that one needs to prove, not that the government bears the burden to prove, not only the actus reus, but also the mens rea, and they are two separate elements. And as Shrewsbury People tells us, they must be established with the same certainty, and the requisite specific intent must be shown as a matter of fact. And so here, not only are we dealing with the issue of Mr. Smith's of no evidence outside of the act itself, but we also compounded with the issue of mental illness in this case. If I may, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. My name is Gabriel Olivares, registration number 45336, and I represent the people in this matter. Our Supreme Court's recent decision in Walker is unequivocal and unambiguous. A defendant may not contest the validity of his right to a jury trial on direct appeal. Rather, he must raise such an argument in a post-conviction proceeding. This holding is not dicta, and regardless of whether it was correctly decided, it is binding. Walker explained that a defendant's right to trial by jury is guaranteed by the United States Constitution and the Colorado Constitution. This right is further safeguarded by the advisement set forth in Rule 23. Walker is clear that the relevant question is not whether the trial court complied with Rule 23, but whether the defendant knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily waived his right to trial by jury. The answer to this question often requires evidence that lies outside the record. Therefore, a post-conviction proceeding is most appropriate.
Counsel, I recognize that the statement that you quote from Walker is a broad statement, and as Judge Hawthorne has pointed out, is repeated several times in the opinion. But don't we have to read that statement in light of the nature of the case before the court and the facts of the case before the court? Otherwise, what you're saying essentially is that the court made some broader pronouncement, some unnecessarily broad pronouncement about the ability to bring these sorts of claims in a direct appeal. Is that what you're saying?
Certainly. I think you can read it broadly, and it should be read that broadly, because the court said the relevant question isn't Rule 23. They didn't decide the case on announced that rule based on the Rule 23 advisement, but rather whether or not the defendant's constitutional rights have been violated.
Do you concede, because I notice there's no argument in your answer brief on this question, do you concede that the record as it currently stands does not indicate that the defendant knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily waived his right to a jury trial?
Well, first I'd like to point out that actually the record is incomplete, because the actual transcript of the hearing I don't believe was ever provided on the record. It was never supplemented because the court reporter didn't provide that, and then counsel took leave for an extension of time to obtain that and never supplemented the record. But regardless, it's not as if there was a complete lack of an advisement. There was a limited advisement, and I would, I'd have to concede that as the transcript is represented in the opening brief, it did not comply with Rule 23. However, that does not mean the defendant's waiver was not knowing, intelligent, or voluntary. And further, counsel makes much reference to his mental health, but just a little over a month before he waived his right to jury trial, he was found to be competent to stand trial, and that finding was not contested. It was explicitly not contested by defense counsel.
Is your reading of the federal cases cited by the defense the same as the defense's reading? That is, that the record at the time of the waiver must show that the waiver was knowing, intelligent, and voluntary, or else it's deemed invalid.
No, I read the cases as saying that the court cannot make a finding of the adequacy of the waiver if the record doesn't support that. The court isn't making a finding right now. It's just saying this has to be adjudicated or adjudicated on post-conviction. On post-conviction, the record can be supplemented with evidence, with expert evidence, with testimony from the attorney, and then the court can make a finding.
But, I mean, if you have the trial court in the heat of trial, as this trial court did, make a finding that it was voluntary, knowing, what's left to do? I mean, aren't you just kind of recreating history if you're doing it post-conviction? Because there's already a finding, and the issue is, did the trial court get it right or not? We have the Supreme Court saying, at least in some cases, maybe all cases, that has to be done in a post-conviction motion, not in a proceeding like this. But I'm trying to figure out what more there would be to do.
Sure, and there was, again, there in this case, there it was not as if there was a complete absence of a record. And again, I would read those cases to say that the ultimate finding whether or not the defendant's waiver was knowing, intelligent, and voluntary has to be supported by the record. Not just the trial court's finding, but the ultimate finding throughout the appeals process.
But don't the federal courts entertain those sorts of claims on direct appeal based upon whatever record exists at that point in time?
At that point, I believe they were on direct appeal, but the federal courts have never said that, at least the United States Supreme Court, I don't believe has ever said that these kind of claims have to be dealt with on direct appeal, and that they can't be dealt with during a post-conviction proceeding. Colorado, the rule in Walker doesn't eliminate the defendant's constitutional right. It just provides for the procedural grounds under which that right can be litigated.
So let me ask questions, I guess, in two extremes on the spectrum. So if a trial court here took the language of the rule and did everything exactly right under the rule, asked every one of those questions, got responsive questions, does that automatically mean that the waiver was constitutionally sufficient?
No, and that's I believe it, either Moore or Walker, the court says that even if the advisement is completely complied with, that does not mean that his waiver was per se valid. Contrary, if the advisement wasn't fully given, doesn't per se mean that the waiver was not valid. It just means we need some more evidence, and that's why oftentimes before that it was remanded for further findings. Here it's just saying, listen, let's get the direct appeal over with and then have an evidentiary hearing. If the trial court deems the evidentiary hearing necessary based on the 35C motion, and then we can go through the appellate process.
Counsel, there is a very real difference, though, between deciding such a claim on direct appeal and then deciding it in a post-conviction motion, and that's the burden of proof. If it's decided on direct appeal, the people would still have the burden of showing, based on the record, that the waiver was knowing, intelligent, and voluntary. In a post-conviction claim, the defendant always has the burden of proof to show that there was some mistake. So how are the defendant's rights fully protected by shunting it to a post-conviction proceeding when the burden of proof is thereby shifted?
And I'm sorry that I confused Walker and Moore, but in one of those cases, it says the burden of proof does not shift on post-conviction review. The defendant must still raise, I guess what you could call a prima facie case on 35C, on his 35C motion, but the people still bear the burden of showing that the waiver was knowing and voluntary and intelligent. The burden does not shift on 35C. Okay. If the court has no further questions about that issue, I'd like to turn to the second issue. I'd like to start out by distinguishing defining what the actus reus was or is in first degree assault, and that actus reus is defined by the statute is causing serious bodily injury. That's differentiated. The actus reus can be distinguished from the circumstances surrounding the actus reus, and the circumstances in this case were sufficient to support the defendant's conviction of first degree murder and more importantly, the trial court's finding that the defendant acted with specific intent to cause serious bodily injury to the victim. Specifically, the circumstances which supported the defendant's conviction were that he used a screwdriver sharpened to resemble an ice pick. He stabbed the victim in the neck, 3 centimeters from her spinal cord. He struck her with such force that it impaled in her neck, punctured and collapsed her lung, and then broke apart from the plastic handle. Even after he stabbed her the first time, he attempted to stab her at least 2 more times, and then attempted to get away after the attack was over. The trial court on the record relied on these circumstances, specifically the type of weapon used, the number of times the defendant struck the victim, and the location he targeted on the victim's body. In attacks like this, in occurrences like this, the state of mind and the intent of the defendant is often concealed from the finder of fact. And so the court has often found that we have to look at the circumstances surrounding the occurrence, and circumstances surrounding the occurrence is a quote from Baker, to infer the defendant's state of mind and intent. This principle was used in Brake, Edwards, and Baird, which I cited in my case. Defendant cites Armijo. Armijo isn't dispositive in this case. Armijo is about instructional error. In that case, the trial court refused to give an instruction for specific intent. The court in Armijo said that's not enough. There has to be a specific finding of the required mens rea. A finding of the actus reus, or in this case, a finding of general intent, is not enough. That's not what we have here. Here we have the trial court making a specific finding of specific intent. Armijo, which Armijo is based on, is also not dispositive. That case was very unusual facts. We don't know any of the circumstances surrounding the attack. We know that it was very likely that the defendant shot the victim. None of the witnesses heard a shot, saw the defendant with a gun at the time of the attack. There was no evidence of any kind of motive in that case, not that motive is required. Here we know many of the circumstances surrounding the attack. I'd also like to briefly address the defendant's mental health as it applies to this issue, because the defendant makes light of that argument. The defendant argues that evidence of mental illness can negate the mens rea element of specific intent crime. We don't argue that. We don't dispute that. And while the defendant's opening brief may have presented abundant evidence of the defendant's mental illness, the defendant chose not to present any of that evidence at trial. In fact, when the prosecutor made reference to the defendant's long mental history leading up to the trial, the defendant objected, saying none of those facts were on the record or in evidence, and they couldn't be discussed during the closing argument.
And what did the trial court do with that objection?
The trial court said, I'm not going to consider any of his mental history because it wasn't in evidence. The only evidence of the defendant's mental state at the time was the testimony of lay witnesses. That evidence, considering the standard of review that we're in, looking at the evidence in a light most favorable to the prosecution, was not enough to reverse the defendant's conviction as a matter of law. If the court has no further questions, I'd ask that you affirm the decision below. Thank you.
Ms. Stevenson, you have 17 seconds.
I would just like to conclude by saying that stabbing with a sharpened instrument 3 centimeters from her lung is the actus reus itself, It was not Mr. Smith's burden to present evidence, and when the government did argue that there was nothing legally present within the evidence that could legally negate the mens rea, and Mr. Smith, I see that I'm out of time, and I finish my sentence.
Yes, you may.
When the government said that there was nothing in the evidence that could legally negate the mens rea in this case, it was actually wrong, because we know that the law states that mental illness can negate the requisite mens rea of specific intent crime. Thank you.
Thank you. And court thanks both counsel, all counsel, for your arguments, both in your briefs and at oral arguments today. Those briefs and arguments will be very helpful to the court in reaching a decision in this case. So the matter will stand submitted to the court, and an opinion will issue in due course. Thank you.